Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to the NHLBI teleconference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. Instructions will be given at that time. If you should require assistance during the call, please press star then zero. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to our host, Dr. Elizabeth Nabel. Please go ahead.
Good morning. This is Diane Stryer, Acting Communications Director for the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. Thank you for participating in this briefing. We will start this morning with a statement from Dr. Elizabeth Nabel, Director of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. Following Dr. Nabel's remarks, several representatives from the leadership of the ACCORD clinical trial will make statements. ACCORD stands for Action to Control Cardiovascular Risk in Diabetes. After the remarks, we will field questions. The AT&T operator will provide instructions for asking questions. If you have not received the press release on ACCORD, it is now online at www.nhlbi.nih.gov. Prepared remarks from this morning will be posted online during the news conference. Dr. Nabel.
Thank you, and good morning. Today we're sharing with you a major finding and decision regarding the ACCORD trial. ACCORD is a large, important clinical trial designed to determine the best ways to decrease the high rate of heart disease among adults with type 2 diabetes who are at especially high risk for heart attack and stroke. As you know, type 2 diabetes is a complex metabolic disease. It results in elevated blood sugar levels. The ACCORD trial, which began in 2001, is testing three treatment approaches. One, intensive lowering of blood sugar levels compared to a standard blood sugar treatment. Two, intensive lowering of blood pressure compared to a standard blood pressure treatment. And three, treatment of blood lipids by a fibrate plus a statin compared to a statin alone. This morning we are announcing the outcome of one of the treatment strategies and a change in how the study will be conducted. After thoroughly reviewing the data collected to date, ACCORD investigators found that among those adults with type 2 diabetes who are at especially high risk of cardiovascular disease, a medical treatment strategy to intensively lower their blood sugar levels below the current guidelines increased the risk of death compared to standard blood sugar lowering treatment. Because of this finding, and at the recommendation of the study's Data and Safety Monitoring Board, the NHLBI is stopping the intensive blood sugar lowering treatment part of this study 18 months early. Although we have stopped this treatment, we will continue to care for all study participants. Participants who are receiving the intensive blood sugar lowering treatment will now receive the standard blood sugar lowering treatment, which aims for blood sugar control similar to that achieved in the general population of similar adults treated for type 2 diabetes, which is an A1C level of about 7.5%. As you know, A1C is a measure of blood sugar levels. The treatment approaches for testing blood pressure and lipid control will continue until the study ends as planned in June 2009. As always, our primary concern is to protect the safety of our study volunteers. We made the decision to stop the intensive treatment approach in the ACCORD study after a thorough review of the health risks to the study participants. We will continue to monitor the health of all study participants. We will seek to understand the underlying causes for this finding, and we will carry on the other important research within ACCORD. These findings from ACCORD will inform treatment decisions for the millions of individuals with type 2 diabetes who are at especially high risk for cardiovascular disease. It's important to note, however, that these results apply only to those individuals who are similar to the study participants. All 10,000 251 participants had type 2 diabetes on average for 10 years when they enrolled in the study. In addition, the ACCORD participants had blood sugar levels that were higher than most type 2 diabetic individuals in the United States today. That is, on entry, their A1C levels were about 8.2%. To be eligible for the study, participants also had to have had known heart disease or at least two risk factors in addition to diabetes, including high blood pressure, high cholesterol, obesity, and/or smoking. In other words, they had diabetes plus other risk factors, which placed them at even higher risk for heart disease than if they had just diabetes alone. In this population of individuals with type 2 diabetes at especially high risk for heart disease, it has been observed that the risk of death is approximately 50 deaths per 1,000 individuals per year, or about 5% per year. All ACCORD participants were randomly assigned to either an intensive medical treatment strategy with a goal to lower A1C levels to less than 6%, or to a standard medical treatment strategy to lower A1C levels to 7 to 7.9%. A variety of FDA-approved medications were used to try to reach the assigned blood sugar goals. Now, here's what the ACCORD researchers found. First, the median A1C level achieved in the intensive treatment group was 6.4%, while the median A1C level in the standard treatment group was 7.5%. In the standard treatment group, we observed 11 deaths per 1,000 individuals per year on average over the 4 years of follow-up. In the intensive treatment group, we observed 14 deaths per 1,000 individuals per year. First and foremost, it is important to recognize that this death rate is lower than what has been previously observed in individuals with type 2 diabetes at especially high risk for heart disease. Third, nonetheless, in the intensive treatment group, there were 257 deaths, and in the standard group, 203 deaths. This is a difference of 54 deaths, or 3 per 1,000 participants per year, over an average of 4 years of treatment. Because of this difference, the increased risk between the two groups outweighed the potential benefits of the intensive treatment strategy on non-fatal events. Accordingly, the NHLBI has made the decision to stop this intensive treatment approach in the trial. This is an important finding, which shows that if you have type 2 diabetes and are at especially high risk for heart disease, very intensive glucose-lowering treatments aimed at normalizing blood glucose to an A1C of less than 6% may be detrimental. These preliminary findings of the ACCORD trial are consistent with recommendations from the American Diabetes Association in three aspects. First and foremost, individuals with diabetes should not change their diabetes treatment without consulting first with their health care provider. Second, we concur with the general recommendations of the ADA that advises people with diabetes to aim for an A1C level of less than 7%, understanding that treatment should be individualized. Third, for this very special group of individuals with diabetes, as exemplified in the ACCORD population, which had an average age of 62 and had diabetes for an average of 10 years and had known heart disease or were at high risk, less stringent A1C goals are likely appropriate with an aim for about 7%. ACCORD researchers have extensively analyzed the data available to date and have not identified any specific cause for the higher death rate among the intensive blood sugar treatment group. We know that the higher death rate is not due to episodes of low blood sugar, known as hypoglycemia, or due to any single drug, including rosiglitazone, or any combination of drugs. As I stated earlier, ACCORD researchers will continue to monitor participants and will conduct additional analyses to try and explain the findings while continuing other important research studies which are part of ACCORD. Now, I'd like to take a minute to describe how the decision to change the blood sugar treatment part of the study was made. The ACCORD Data and Safety Monitoring Board, or DSMB, is an independent group of 10 experts who were appointed by the NHLBI to regularly examine study outcomes and safety data. The DSMB has expertise in diabetes, cardiovascular disease, statistics, ethics, epidemiology, and clinical trials. This group is responsible for providing recommendations to the NHLBI on starting, continuing, or stopping the study or portions of the study. The DSMB carefully considers the safety and efficacy of the study treatments and monitors the overall conduct of the study. Importantly, the DSMB recommendations are based on safeguarding the interests of the study participants. Since the study began in 2001, the DSMB has met regularly, generally every 6 months, to monitor study conduct and to review the ACCORD data. In its regular review of the study data, the ACCORD DSMB noted an unexpected higher total death rate from any cause among participants who had been randomly assigned to the intensive blood sugar treatment group compared to those assigned to the standard blood sugar treatment group, the difference of 54 deaths, which I described a moment ago. Although there appeared to be some benefit of an overall lower death rate in both groups, the DSMB recommended stopping the intensive treatment because the difference in deaths between the intensive and standard treatment groups existed. That is, the harm of the very intensive treatment outweighed the potential benefit. The NHLBI accepted the DSMB's recommendation to stop the intensive treatment group, and the NHLBI decided to continue treating all ACCORD participants at the standard treatment approach, as well as to continue the blood pressure and lipid treatment parts of the study. We will continue to monitor all study participants for an additional 18 months as planned until the study ends in June 2009. As I emphasized earlier, on the whole, the death rates in both blood sugar treatment groups were lower than those seen in similar populations. That is, although the death rate was higher in the intensive treatment group than the standard group, it was still lower than death rates reported in other studies of type 2 diabetes in similar adults. As people with diabetes learn the results of the ACCORD trial, we advise them to consult with their healthcare professional before making any changes to their treatment. This is an important message that we will repeat multiple times today. The NHLBI felt it was important to inform study participants and the diabetes community soon after reaching this decision. Accordingly, letters were sent to all study participants by their clinical site principal investigators on Monday, February 4, with recommendations regarding further follow-up care. Investigators have begun to prepare a report of these initial findings, which they will submit for publication in a peer-reviewed medical journal. We anticipate that these findings will be published shortly. So to summarize then, ACCORD is the first major clinical trial to study whether lowering a raised blood sugar level to a level similar to that seen in people without diabetes, reduces the risk of cardiovascular disease. We now have one part of the answer to this question. The study will continue to examine other ways to lower the risk of cardiovascular disease in high-risk adults with type 2 diabetes using blood pressure and lipid-lowering approaches. Our message to individuals with type 2 diabetes who are at especially high risk for heart disease is to target your A1C level to about 7% and not to more intensive levels. No one with diabetes should change their treatment without consulting with their healthcare professional first, and we concur with the ADA recommendations that treatments must be individualized. We now are fortunate to have several experts with us today who have contributed enormously to this research and who will provide additional detail about the ACCORD study and these important initial findings. I'm going to introduce them to you, and then several will be making comments. First, Dr. William Friedewald is clinical professor of public health and medicine at Columbia University and chairman of the ACCORD steering committee. Dr. Herzl Gerstein is professor at McMaster University and Hamilton Health Sciences in Ontario, where he holds the Population Health Institute Chair in Diabetes Research. Dr. Gerstein is principal investigator of one of the seven ACCORD Clinical Center networks and led the group that designed the blood sugar treatment approaches. Dr. Judith Fratkin is director of the Division of Diabetes, Endocrinology, and Metabolic Diseases at the National Institute for Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases here at the NIH, and is the key person from NIDDK involved in ACCORD over its duration. Also with us to answer your question are Dr. John Buse, professor of medicine and Chief of Endocrinology at the University of North Carolina School of Medicine and Vice Chair of the ACCORD Steering Committee. Dr. Buse also serves as President of Medicine and Science of the American Diabetes Association. We also have Dr. Robert Byington, Professor in the Department of Epidemiology and Prevention in the Division of Public Health Sciences at Wake Forest University School of Medicine, who leads the ACCORD Coordinating Center, and also Dr. Denise Simons-Morton, Project Officer for ACCORD at the NHLBI and a member of the ACCORD Steering Committee. Dr. Friedewald will start. Dr. Friedewald?
Thank you, Betsy. As Dr. Nabel has just described, ACCORD first began recruiting participants in 2001. We have been treating and following our study participants for an average of about 4 years, ranging individually from 2 to 7 years. At the same time that we began to observe the troubling mortality differences described by Dr. Nabel, we were also noticing a slight trend toward beneficial effects of the intensive blood sugar lowering. The primary outcome of this for our study is a combination of heart attacks, stroke, and cardiovascular death. And we were seeing about 10% fewer non-fatal cardiovascular events, such as heart attacks, in the intensive treatment group compared to the standard treatment group. However, it appeared that if a heart attack did occur, it was more likely to be fatal. In addition, the intensive treatment group had more unexpected sudden deaths, even without a clear heart attack. The ACCORD researchers undertook extensive analyses to try and understand potential causes of this mortality difference. Our analyses have not identified to date any specific cause for the increased deaths among the intensive treatment group. However, the magnitude of the difference in the death rate, with only a small improvement in non-fatal events, indicated that, in the interest of safety of the participants, the intensive blood sugar treatment part of the ACCORD study should be changed, and all participants treated according to the standard blood sugar group. As we examined the data, we sought to identify any drugs or combinations of drugs that might explain this higher mortality rate in our intensively treated group. However, with our analyses so far, we have not been able to find conclusive evidence that any medication or combination of medications is responsible for the increased risks. Because of the recent concerns raised with regard to rosiglitazone, also known as Avandia, one of the drugs we use in ACCORD, we specifically analyzed the data to try and determine whether there was any link between this particular medication and the increased deaths we were seeing in the ACCORD intensive treatment group. At this time, we have found no link, and thus the use of rosiglitazone does not seem to explain the increased mortality. Based on other studies, it is possible that the intensive blood sugar lowering therapy benefits patients in other ways, such as by lowering the risk of other complications of diabetes, such as eye and kidney diseases. We will continue to analyze all of the effects of the intensive treatment group based on the data gathered to date and on future assessments of the participants in the intensive group, even though they will now be treated to standard blood sugar lowering goals. In addition to actively monitoring ACCORD participants, we will conduct additional analyses to try and explain the findings. Meanwhile, we are preparing a report, as Dr. Nabel mentioned, of our current findings for publication in a peer-reviewed medical journal in the near future. In a moment, Dr. Gerstein will provide more details on how the blood sugar treatment part of the study was conducted and how ACCORD will continue over the next 18 months. Before I close, however, I want to reiterate Dr. Nabel's comments and assure everyone, especially our study volunteers, that our first priority is to the safety of our participants. On Monday, our 77 clinical centers across the United States and Canada sent letters to each study participant explaining this important finding and describing the changes in the ACCORD study. For the participants in the standard treatment group, their care will continue without changes. Participants in the intensive treatment group will be transitioned to the standard treatment after consulting with their ACCORD clinician. They will be called by their study doctor in the next few days so they can discuss, without delay, any concerns or questions they may have. Although the ACCORD findings are extremely important, most individuals with type 2 diabetes are not treated to blood sugar levels as low as those tested in the intensive treatment group in the study. In addition, these results only apply to patients like the ACCORD participants who were selected to have cardiovascular disease or two additional risk factors for cardiovascular disease in addition to their diabetes. To reach the levels of blood sugar achieved by our intensive group required consistent hard work on the part of these participants with frequent blood sugar monitoring, multiple medications, and frequent contact with our ACCORD clinical staff diabetes experts. However, for this special group of individuals with diabetes, as exemplified in the ACCORD population, which had an average age of 62, had diabetes for an average of 10 years, and had known heart disease or at high risk, less stringent A1C goals are likely appropriate, with an aim for around 7%. No one with diabetes should change their treatment without consulting with their healthcare professional first. Finally, I would also like to reiterate that even with the higher death rate in our intensive group compared to our standard group, this rate is still lower than that seen in similar populations in other studies, and it is lower among individuals with type 2 diabetes in the general community. I would now like to turn to my colleague, Dr. Herschel Gerstein, who leads the ACCORD Clinical Center Network in Canada and the ACCORD Blood Sugar Working Group. Herschel will describe the blood sugar treatments used in the ACCORD trial. Herschel?
Thank you, Bill. Before we go into more detail regarding the blood sugar treatment approach in ACCORD, I'd like to take a few minutes to describe why we tested an intensive blood sugar lowering approach. Adults with type 2 diabetes are 2 to 4 times more likely to have a heart attack, stroke, or to die from cardiovascular disease than people without diabetes. This likelihood is even higher if an individual with type 2 diabetes is middle-aged or older, has had a heart attack or stroke in the past, and has other risk factors for cardiovascular disease. Other risk factors include high blood pressure, high cholesterol, being overweight or obese, or being a smoker. A large body of research has shown that higher glucose levels predict a higher likelihood of fatal and non-fatal cardiovascular events. Other studies have shown that lowering blood sugar levels can significantly lower the risk of certain complications of diabetes, such as eye, nerve, and kidney diseases. In addition, a major study in people with type 1 diabetes, which is a different form of diabetes that used to be called juvenile diabetes, suggests that intensive blood sugar lowering strategies reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease and death. Furthermore, a study in people with more recent onset of type 2 diabetes than ACCORD participants showed a trend toward fewer heart attacks. This body of research strongly suggests that lowering glucose levels to levels typically observed in people without diabetes could reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease in people with established type 2 diabetes. But until ACCORD, no major clinical trial had studied whether lowering a raised blood sugar level to a level similar to that seen in people without diabetes reduces the risk of cardiovascular disease in people with type 2 diabetes. In addition, no clinical trial has studied the effects of intensive blood sugar lowering in people with long-standing type 2 diabetes who already had cardiovascular disease or who have multiple risk factors for cardiovascular disease in addition to diabetes. So, one of the key questions that ACCORD was designed to answer is whether intensively lowering blood sugar levels could reduce the risk of heart attack and stroke. Doctors Nabel and Friedewald have described the basic design of the study and the characteristics of the study participants. The two blood sugar lowering approaches studied by researchers in 77 centers in the United States and Canada used lifestyle approaches focused on modifying diet and physical activity together with glucose lowering drugs. All of the drugs were FDA approved and are commonly used for glucose control in the general diabetes population. The choice of drugs was based on the doctor's medical judgment that took the clinical characteristics of the participant into consideration while maximizing safety and glucose lowering effectiveness. Thus, the treatments used in ACCORD were similar to those used by practicing physicians who treat patients in the community. Drugs representing all of the types of glucose-lowering therapies available when ACCORD began in 2001 were used, and a few more drugs were added as they became available. The same menu of medications were used in both treatment groups, although in different combinations and doses. The medications included metformin, thiazolidinediones, or TZDs, such as rosiglitazone or pioglitazone, injectable insulins, sulfonylureas, such as glimepiride, glipizide, gliburide, and glycoside, acarbose, and exenatide. Although the same drugs were used by both treatment strategy groups, more drug combinations and higher doses were prescribed to participants assigned to the intensive glucose-lowering group than the standard group in order to reach their targeted A1C goal. Participants in the intensive treatment group were seen approximately every 2 months at an ACCORD clinical center, and participants in the standard group were seen approximately every 4 months. At each visit, clinical staff reviewed the participant's health status, discussed with the participant any side effects of drugs, adjusted medication doses as needed, tested the participant's blood sugar, and performed other measures as appropriate. Volunteer participants in both groups also received most drugs free. They received state-of-the-art medical care with access to diet and physical activity counseling, experts in diabetes care, and the latest information related to diabetes. They were also provided with free glucose monitoring equipment, so they could check their own blood sugar levels and make adjustments at home to achieve the goals to which they had been assigned. It is our view that the high standard of care received by all participants contributed to the lower death rates in both groups compared to the rates seen in the general community. On average, the volunteer participants in both treatment strategy groups achieved a stable level of glucose within 6 to 9 months after being enrolled. the average blood sugar levels for both groups were lower than when they entered the study. The intensive treatment group achieved lower average A1C values than the standard treatment group participants. Half of the participants in the intensive group achieved an A1C of less than 6.4%. In the standard treatment group, half of the participants achieved an A1C of less than 7.5%. Both groups have maintained stable glucose control throughout the study, which to date has been an average of about 4 years. Now, I'd like to turn to Dr. Judy Fradkin from the NIH's National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Disease.
Thank you, Herzl. I've been asked to address the implication of these new findings from the ACCORD study for diabetes patients. I will focus my remarks on type 2 diabetes, the form of diabetes being studied in ACCORD. Type 2 diabetes is by far the most common form of diabetes in the United States. It accounts for about 95% of the nearly 21 million diabetes cases in the country. Type 2 diabetes is most common in adults age 40 and older. It is strongly associated with obesity, inactivity, a family history of diabetes, and racial or ethnic background. Minority groups are at particularly high risk. As Dr. Nabel noted earlier, type 2 diabetes is a complex metabolic disease that results in elevated blood glucose levels. It usually begins as insulin resistance, a disorder in which cells in fat, liver, and muscle do not respond to or use insulin properly. As the need for insulin rises, the pancreas gradually loses its ability to secrete enough insulin to meet the body's needs. At diagnosis, many patients do not need medication, and most patients do well with oral medications such as metformin. Over time, however, they have a progressive loss in insulin production, and they need additional medications to control their diabetes. Eventually, especially if not well controlled, type 2 diabetes causes damage to the eyes, nerves, kidneys, heart, and blood vessels. Many people with diabetes also have high blood pressure and lipid or cholesterol problems, conditions that further add to their risk for cardiovascular disease. About 65% of people with diabetes die from heart disease or stroke. Diabetes is increasingly important as a cause of cardiovascular disease in the United States. I would now like to briefly review how ACCORD is different from earlier studies. One crucial way in which ACCORD differed from earlier clinical studies is that it studied the effects of lowering glucose to a near normal level, a lower level than that targeted in earlier studies. ACCORD also differed in another critical way from earlier studies aimed at preventing complications through intensive glucose control. At enrollment, ACCORD patients were older. They were on average 62 years old. They had lived with diabetes for a longer time, an average of 10 years, and they were at especially high risk of cardiovascular disease. In contrast, participants in the earlier studies of intensive glucose control were younger, had recently been diagnosed with diabetes, and were not at a similar high risk for cardiovascular disease. It is not yet known whether controlling glucose to near normal levels will prevent heart disease and extend life in other groups, such as younger people with diabetes, those earlier in the course of the disease, and in whom glucose is easier to control, and those without established cardiovascular disease. So what have we learned from ACCORD so far? These new findings give us important information. They show that a medical strategy to intensively lower blood glucose to a goal of near normal or non-diabetic levels increases the risk of death and outweighs the potential benefits of such therapy for this specific group of patients, those with established or long-standing type 2 diabetes who have cardiovascular disease or at especially high risk for it. In this group of patients, and with the treatments that are currently available to us, clinicians should be wary of striving for intensive glucose control to near normal levels. The ACCORD trial tells us that patients with diabetes and a high likelihood of established heart disease should not aim for near normal levels of blood glucose, levels that are rarely achieved with current medical care in comparable patients. We've learned that a one-size approach does not fit all in treating diabetes, and the ACCORD findings reinforce this message. The National Diabetes Education Program, which is sponsored by the National Institutes of Health and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, promotes the American Diabetes Association's guidelines for diabetes care. Under these guidelines, the A1C goal for most patients with diabetes is less than 7%. The guidelines also state that treatment should be tailored to individual needs. For example, a less stringent A1C goal should be considered for people with severe or frequent hypoglycemia or those with a limited life expectancy. In tailoring therapy to determine an individual patient's A1C goal, physicians should now consider whether the patient has established cardiovascular disease or additional cardiovascular risk factors. I want to stress that ACCORD is studying the effects of intensive glucose control in type 2 diabetes. We cannot extrapolate its results to patients with type 1 diabetes, which is a different form of diabetes.
Thank you very much, Judy, and thank you to all our speakers this morning. In summary, we have discontinued the intensive blood sugar treatment strategy in the ACCORD trial and will now treat all of the ACCORD participants according to the standard blood sugar treatment strategy. The ACCORD blood pressure and lipid trials are continuing. The findings we're reporting to you today are extremely important for the care of individuals with diabetes around the world. They indicate that in older individuals with diabetes who also have existing heart disease or two or more heart disease risk factors, such as high blood pressure, elevated blood cholesterol, obesity or overweight, and smoking, care should be taken not to intensively lower their blood sugar levels to a near normal level using combinations of medications available today. Now we will move on, and we're very pleased to take your questions. Before so, I want to just highlight a couple things. First of all, the press release, a question and answer sheet, and these prepared remarks have been posted at the NHLBI website at www.nhlbi.nih.gov. A transcript of this teleconference will be posted in the next 2 days. And in addition, a recording of this press conference will be available within about 30 minutes after the end of the conference, and I'll give you that phone number at the very end. So, operator, if we could move now to our questions. I would just ask that you identify yourself and your organization.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone phone. You will hear a tone indicating you have been placed in queue. You may remove yourself from queue at any time by pressing the pound key. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up the handset before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, please press star one at this time. One moment for the first question. Our first question is from the line of Jacob Goldstein from Wall Street Journal. Your line is open, sir. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Can you talk a little bit more about the risk of death in comparable populations in other studies and in why the intensive treatment group in this study had a lower risk of death? And also, if you've calculated the p-value for the difference between the intensive treatment group and the standard treatment group in this study, what is that value?
I'm going to ask Dr. Gerstein and Dr. Buse to address your comments in just a moment. These findings are initial. I just want to emphasize that the analysis are continuing, and details regarding the data will be reviewed by the study PIs and prepared for a peer-reviewed publication. So at this point, we are not in a position to release details regarding p-values or other analyses. Dr. Gerstein and Dr. Buse?
The answer to the question is that large epidemiologic studies which have followed people with type 2 diabetes of a similar age and with risk factors of similar cardiovascular type risk factors have reported total mortality rates in the order of 4 to 6% per year depending on the study. And there have been a number of these that have been reported. Now, these are community-based studies that are out in the general population of people, and they reflect whatever care these individuals are providing. Within the ACCORD trial, people received state-of-the-art medical care, had frequent contact with healthcare providers and experts in diabetes, had access to all of the medications essentially available to deal with diabetes, and we feel that it is this expert care that they were able to have that led all of the participants in ACCORD to have a much lower rate than is seen in the general population of people with diabetes and similar risk factors.
This is John Buse. The only thing I would add to Herzl's answer is that also remember the ACCORD study also involves a blood pressure and cholesterol randomization. So all the patients or the patients in general had excellent care of other cardiovascular risk factors as well. And that likely contributes to the general low mortality rate in the study.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Julie Steenhuisen from Reuters. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. A couple of things. I'm really curious if you can tell us how many of the deaths that you've noted were actually cardiovascular related. Were they, whether heart attack, stroke, or, can you tease that out a bit more for us? And also, does this raise new questions about, a surrogate endpoint of, lowering blood sugar, or is this population too specific to start questioning the merits of intensive blood sugar lowering as a surrogate endpoint? Thank you.
Thank you for your question. I'm going to ask Dr. Friedewald to address your two questions.
Okay.
Yeah, as expected in a population like this, the mortality mainly was from cardiovascular disease, and roughly about half of the deaths were cardiovascular, as expected. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I didn't fully understand your second question. Could you repeat it?
Well, we're seeing a lot, in the broader cardiovascular area, we're seeing a lot of debate right now about surrogate endpoints. And I'm wondering, the assumption was that lower would be better in this study. You didn't find that, and that's somewhat of a surprise. I think we were a bit surprised in the Vitorin study as well. And I'm wondering if, what does this say about making assumptions on endpoints as surrogates for actual studies that show reduction in death?
Well, the answer is obvious, I think, and that is if you want to study the important events, which are the clinical events, which is what we did.
Mm-hmm.
Surrogates are only as good to the limit that they are true surrogates for the clinical event,
mm-hmm.
and we make assumptions frequently because it is easier, smaller sample sizes to study surrogate endpoints. But, in fact, if we can, we want to study the clinical endpoint, and that's why we studied this in ACCORD, and that's why we had to have 10,251 patients, because
mm-hmm.
when you study these kinds of clinical events, although they're much higher than the general population, they still aren't that common, and that's why you need a large population.
I think it's also important to remember that this was a medical treatment strategy to lower A1C levels to near normal levels in the population. So the A1C level in and of itself was not a surrogate endpoint. And in fact, the primary outcome for the study is a combination of heart attack, stroke, and cardiovascular death. So those the clinical endpoints really were the primary outcome.
Okay, thank you very much.
Our next question is from the line of Steve Sternberg from USA Today. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Could you specify the causes of death? Could you also tell us what percent of patients in the intensive arm were getting rosiglitazone and what percentage of patients in the standard treatment group were getting rosiglitazone? And I also wanted to ask you about an ethical question, and that is that rosiglitazone now has two black box warnings attached to it, and back in May, concerns were raised, as you know, about its effect in heart attacks, and I wonder if that, you know, what you think about how about the difficulty in teasing out what this study means and how rosiglitazone may have contributed to that confusion.
I'm going to ask our chair and vice chair of the Accord Steering Committee to address those questions, Dr. Frieda Waldenduck.
Now let me start out, and maybe John can follow up with the black boxes after that. Let me make it clear that this was a treatment strategy so that both groups, as you commented, received rosiglitazone. More rosiglitazone was used in the intensive treatment group compared to the standard treatment group. So when we tried to understand whether rosiglitazone was responsible for this increase in mortality, we couldn't rely on randomization. We had to do what we call an epidemiological analysis. And by that I mean we had to then look at people who were assigned to rosiglitazone and compare their mortality experience to those who were not on rosiglitazone. And there are problems with those kinds of analyses, but we do them routinely. When we did that in Accord, what we observed was that there was no increased mortality in the group assigned to rosiglitazone compared to those who were not. So it did not explain, at least as far as the analyses we've been able to do, did not explain the increased mortality. John, do you want to respond to
that? Yeah, the only thing I would add, just to clarify, no patients were assigned to rosiglitazone. They were assigned to an intensive strategy versus a standard strategy, and the investigators were free to use whatever combination of drugs they wanted to achieve those targets in the two different arms. With regards to the black box warnings and meta-analyses over the last 6 months to a year with rosiglitazone, this has been reviewed repeatedly by the investigators, by the DSMB, by the Institute, by the project office, by the statisticians, by basically everybody involved in Accord. This was discussed with every participant in Accord. Some patients did switch from rosiglitazone to pioglitazone or from rosiglitazone to other medications over the last 6 months. But I don't think there's a direct relevance of the black box warnings and what has happened in Accord.
Dr. Yes. Simons-Morton?
Yes, thank you. I'm the Accord Project Officer at NHLBI. I would like to add that we actually convened a special urgent meeting of our Data and Safety Monitoring Board, and the information about rosiglitazone came out, and we asked the DSMB to analyze the publications that had come out in the New England Journal of Medicine and subsequent publications, and also at the same time to look at analyses within Accord of the Accord data in the Accord participants. And we did post a public statement about that, which is still available on our website. And at that time and still today, we could find no link between the use of rosiglitazone and the mortality findings or any other adverse outcome in the trial.
Thank you very much.
Our next question comes from the line of Richard Knox with National Public Radio. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Just to follow up on Steve's question, can you tell us what proportion of patients in the standard and intensive groups did receive rosiglitazone?
Can I answer that? So it's actually quite a difficult question to answer. This is Dr. Simons-Morton again. Because the treatments changed over time. And so we've been treating these patients for an average of 4 years, and some people were put on rosiglitazone and then taken off, and other additional medications were added over time. And so it's not an easy question to answer. It's a question of were they ever on rosiglitazone, were they on rosiglitazone at their latest visit, et cetera, et cetera. And we really would prefer that level of detail to be available for the peer-reviewed publication.
I suppose one way to look at it would be the number of patient days on rosiglitazone in each group.
Thank you for that excellent suggestion. We'll take that under consideration.
You haven't done that, I take it.
I don't believe the Coordinating Center has done that particular analysis.
Okay. Thanks.
Our next question comes from the line of Gina Collada from New York Times. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my question. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how difficult it was to achieve this very intensive blood sugar control. How many drugs on average were they taking, or what kinds of doses, and what was it like for the patients to undergo that sort of intensive control? And also, I was wondering if you could tell us how big a surprise was this for you? I mean, did you, I know every time you end a study early, it's got to be a surprise, but in terms of the things that have happened in diabetes, was this truly a major shock, or had you thought maybe something like this might happen?
Bina, let me address your last question first, and then I'll ask Dr. Gerstein to address your first question. Clearly, we did not anticipate the findings, and in that sense, we were surprised. But now, knowing the findings, we took the important step of stopping the intensive treatment arm due to safety concerns. We've recommitted ourselves to continuing to monitor the study participants, and in addition, the study investigators will continue to explore potential reasons for the findings while continuing with the other important research studies within ACCORD. We felt at the onset that this was one of the most important questions. What is the best treatment for individuals with type 2 diabetes who are at very high risk for heart disease? And we are still committed to finding the answer to that question. I'll ask Dr. Gerstein to address the others.
Could I follow on that?
Yes, please.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons we do this research, as you understand, obviously. We obviously were surprised. We were hoping for a positive outcome, but the reason we do this research is we don't know that, and that's why we had to do this study. Mm-hmm.
As Dr. Gerstein, the answer to the question related to the difficulty and the work that had to be done to achieve this is very important. So I want to start off by saying that the average A1C level of participants in the ACCORD trial at the time that they started was 8.2%, which suggests that the glucose control was not good and was higher than it typically is in the United States. Set ourselves a very challenging goal of trying to get the A1C level down as efficiently and as safely as possible, and it does require a lot of work. We had to use participants around ACCORD used at least two drugs in addition to diet and lifestyle approaches, other drugs were added as they were needed. Many patients needed to use insulin in addition to pills and all sorts of combinations. Patients had to have frequent contact with the sites coming for a visit at least every 2 months, but subsequently having phone contact and interactions on a very regular and frequent basis. And participants, volunteers, checked their glucose levels at home and were taught how to make adjustments to their own medications in order to facilitate achieving these values. So this is no easy task for people to do, and they did it, and they, with the support of their of the sites and the doctors and the nurses who were involved.
Well, what was the difference between doing the very intensive in the life of a patient, if you were trying to do the intensive control as compared to trying to do the less intense control?
So imagine that you're a patient with diabetes and you're in the intensive group, then you need to prick your finger and write down your blood sugar level about 3 to 5 times a day. That means you have to interrupt your routine. You may have to take 3 or 4 injections of insulin during the day in addition to 2 pills at breakfast, 2 at lunch, and maybe 2 or 3 at supper, in addition to what other drugs you may be taking for blood pressure or for asthma or whatever other problems that you may have. You need to see if your numbers are high, that you need to do something about it, speak to your site, etc. If you were in the standard group, then the amount of work that you had to do was considerably less. You would have to check your blood sugar perhaps once or twice a day, depending on what medications you were on, see the site every 3 to 4 months, and not be concerned if the blood sugar levels were in the levels that they've been even before people got involved with the study. So it is really a different amount of work that both the patient and you would have to do as a patient, as well as the site would have to do.
Were people in the I'm sorry to keep going on about this, but I just want to sort of understand what the difference was for the patients. Were people in the intensive group also at risk, or were they complaining if they were passing out from having their blood from overshooting it, getting their blood sugar too low? And did that happen in the standard group?
Patients in both the intensive group and the standard group would tell us that they found the experience and they continue to find the experience enjoyable in terms of the frequent interaction with the staff and the amount of access and medical therapy that they were receiving. People in both the intensive and the standard group did have occasional episodes of hypoglycemia that required adjustment in therapies, and this, as you can imagine, was also followed. So both groups did have this, and both groups will continue to be followed in order to see in the end whether or not the other parts of the trial, the blood pressure, the lipid parts of the trial, are affecting cardiovascular events.
Dr. Buse?
Just to add a little bit, something that I think is important with regards to the approach between the two groups. As you heard, the average A1C in the standard group was 7.5%, you know, pretty much right in the middle of the range we were looking for. So most patients in that group were giving pats and rubs that you know, that they had achieved the target for the ACCORD study. In the intensive group, the average was around 6.4%, not under 6%, which was the target. So there was this sort of constant pushing to, you know, can we do this with diet? Can we change your medication here? Maybe if you monitored a little bit more here. So there, it was a more demanding process, certainly, for the patients in the intensive group.
Thank you.
And really, all the ACCORD participants, you know, need to be congratulated for, you know, a heroic effort. I mean, doing much better than average in the United States in glucose control over a prolonged period of time, with all kinds of stuff in the press leading to concerns and that sort of thing. I mean, they really did an amazing job.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Randolph Schmidt from Associated Press. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yes, I'm curious. There's a paper coming out in the New England Journal of Medicine which talks about a similar study, and they found lower deaths in the intensive blood sugar lowering group. And I'm wondering if you're familiar with that paper and if you've how it compares with what you found.
Yes, we understand that that paper is under embargo until
yes.
5 p.m. today.
Mm-hmm.
However, the group has published a design paper that appeared in 2003,
mm-hmm.
An outcome paper, excuse me, that was published in 2003,
mm-hmm.
And which we've had a chance to look at.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the level A1C levels that are achieved in their intensive treatment arm, it roughly is equivalent to what was achieved in our standard treatment arm.
Okay.
And there may be individuals here who'd like to comment further. John?
Well, I think the major difference between that study and ACCORD is that study, the people that were in the intensive arm all got intense blood sugar
mm-hmm.
lowering as they could do at the time, intensive blood pressure lowering and intensive cholesterol lowering.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in the 2003 report, the A1C level achieved was around 7.8 or 7.9, so certainly, you know, higher than the standard patients in our study, but they were all managed to blood pressure and cholesterol, and I think really the importance of that study was the demonstration that taking care of blood sugar, blood pressure, and cholesterol together does seem
okay.
to reduce cardiovascular endpoints.
And to build upon that, let's not lose sight of the fact that while much of our discussion this morning is about blood sugar levels,
right.
that equally important parts of the ACCORD trial are blood pressure and lipid management as well. And certainly we want to emphasize, and this is in full agreement with the ADA recommendations, that treatment for individuals with diabetes should pay attention to all cardiovascular risk factors, including cholesterol lowering and blood pressure lowering, where appropriate. So again, you know, as the CORD study unfolds, and certainly over the next 18 months, we will actively continue the blood pressure and lipid randomization arms. And at the study, at the end of the study, we are confident that we will have very interesting information about the integration of blood glucose, blood pressure, and lipid treatment in individuals with type 2 diabetes.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Ron Winslow from the Wall Street Journal. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
thank you very much. Actually, you were just speaking exactly to my question. And in evaluating, you know, this mortality increase or increased risk of mortality, how did you look at this other background therapy and with lipids and blood pressure? I'm assuming you've ruled out some association, but how did you connect, you know, the levels that people achieved in that part of the strategy with what was happening with the glucose, and was there any impact at all?
Yeah, I'll provide just a general comment, and then Dr. Byington, who directs the coordinating center, will provide more information. Obviously, when we examined the safety data, we looked at all components of the trial, and we looked very carefully to see whether we would need to discontinue either the blood pressure or the lipid arm of the trial. And the safety data suggested that we did not need to do that. Again, all of the details regarding this will be in the peer review manuscript, so I don't want to jump the gun here too much, especially since the analysis are still being prepared by the study investigators. But I think Dr. Byington will have more to add on that.
Yes, I can add a little bit more to that. Dr. Nabel just mentioned how we can't say too much because of the ongoing work that we're doing now for publication in the next few weeks or so. We're trying to put together a paper. But also, in addition, we're working towards continuing to follow our patients and treat our patients in the blood pressure and in the lipid trials. So I can't give you any details about exactly what was going on in that, but I can assure you that we did actually look at any possible interactions between our two treatment groups, intensive versus standard glycemia treatment groups, in terms of what was also going on in the blood pressure trial and also what was going on in the lipid trial, and we did not see anything that caused us any concern. So that's why those two trials are, the recommendation has been made to continue those two trials.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Matthew Harper from Forbes magazine. Please go ahead.
I just was hoping that you could all revisit, and I'd particularly like to hear what Dr. Buse thinks, but about the issue of A1C as a surrogate marker. I mean, given a trial where an overly aggressive treatment strategy led to an imbalance in mortality, don't you have to wonder about how to value and use this surrogate marker, both in treating and in evaluating new drugs, and if not, why not? I'd kind of like some more clarity on that.
Yeah, so the notion of a surrogate marker, it basically is, as I suspect you know, that it's a way of determining future risk based on something that you can measure today. And hemoglobin A1C has been shown to do that for microvascular complications in clinical trials and trends towards being useful in that regard with regards to cardiovascular disease. But in ACCORD, hemoglobin A1C is not being used as a surrogate marker. It's a target. If the question that you're asking is really about the utility of hemoglobin A1C is a surrogate marker for relevant outcomes in patients with type 2 diabetes, I think that's still an arguable point and not something that ACCORD addresses directly, but you know, it is an issue about which there's been a great deal of discussion over the last 6 months in the context of drug studies.
May I add to that, Dr. Gerstein, that when used as a target in other studies, for instance, in people with type 1 diabetes, it's been very clearly shown that targeting a particular hemoglobin A1C level, or an A1C level, a low A1C level, does reduce the risk of heart attacks and strokes and cardiovascular events. And in type 2 diabetes, it has been shown that targeting that A1C level reduces the risk of eye disease and nerve disease and kidney disease in the past. So we are continuing to learn more about this, and these findings, in addition to other trials that are still continuing and will be completed within the next 2 years or so, will tell us a lot more about the optimal way and the best and the safest and most effective way of reducing cardiovascular events and mortality in people with type 2 diabetes.
Does that answer your question, Mr. Harper?
Seeing this as something that doesn't. I'm having a little trouble seeing how. Obviously, this wasn't a study designed to evaluate a surrogate marker, but I'm trying to understand how the surrogate marker isn't. How the use of the surrogate marker isn't affected by such a negative result in using it as a treatment.
So maybe one thing that would clarify things a little bit about the utility of hemoglobin A1C as a surrogate marker and what ACCORD means in that regard. In general, it doesn't appear that hemoglobin A1C explains the problem with excess mortality in the ACCORD study. There's a lot more analyses that need to be done in that regard, but I just think in many ways the ACCORD study is irrelevant to the issue of is hemoglobin A1C a valid surrogate marker.
One more comment, and then we would be more than happy to follow up with you after the call.
So this is Dr. Simons-Morton again. I just have something to add that ACCORD, obviously, because it was testing a strategy of treatment, a therapeutic strategy that could use lifestyle and multiple medications as they would be used in actual clinical practice, ACCORD was not designed to answer the question about the effectiveness of any individual drug on, for example, like drug companies do when they're trying to get a drug approved. It's a different kind of question. It's more of a practical, in-practice question. And I think that maybe thinking of it that way might help with the issue of surrogates. We weren't intending to answer the question about whether A1C was a surrogate.
Again, the point that we wanted to mimic real-life treatments to achieve certain targets was really the emphasis of the study, using combinations of FDA-approved medications. But thank you for your question. We'd be happy to follow up with you after the call if you'd like to discuss it further.
Yeah, that would be great.
Our next question comes from Lyman at Avery Comaro from U.S. News and World Reports. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Good morning. Thank you for taking these questions. I have a few, if you don't mind. Following up on Ron Winslow's question about the blood pressure and lipid groups, was there any major difference in the number of excess deaths across these two arms, the blood pressure group and the lipid group? That's number one. And within the groups, were there clear indications in the intensive blood pressure group and the standard blood pressure group and the intensive lipid group and the standard blood pressure group? That's question one. Do you want to deal with that, and then I can ask a couple of others? Or
sure. We aren't going to be able to provide detail at this time because that will really be the subject of the manuscript, which is being prepared and needs to be peer-reviewed. Let me just reiterate that we looked very carefully at the data with the safety of the study participants paramount in our mind. If there had been safety concerns, we would have discontinued one or both of those arms.
I understand, but in terms of this isn't detail, it seems to me. If you saw numbers that were clearly tilted toward blood pressure or toward lipids, that would have jumped out at you, wouldn't it?
Well, remember that the blood pressure and lipid arms are blinded, so those components have not been unblinded to the study investigators yet. And I'll let Dr. Binnington follow up.
And just to follow up on what I said earlier, those two trials are still ongoing, so that's one of the reasons why we can't give you any specific numbers right now, because that would be a clue as what's going on in terms of those trials, information that you'll be getting in 18 months.
But I understand that which patients were in intensive and which were in standard treatment groups were blinded. Are you saying that the investigators who analyzed the data won't even know until unblinding which patients, all patients were getting both blood pressure and lipid treatment? Isn't that distinction unblinded now?
This is a factorial trial, as we tried to explain. So what we are talking about today are the randomization between the two glycemia approaches. There was also a separate randomization for blood pressure and a separate randomization for the lipid trial. Among the people sitting around here at the table now, there are only a handful who know those data. Dr. Gerstein and Dr. Buse do not know those data because they are blinded with regard to the outcomes. They clearly know which group people are in, but they don't know the group data and they don't know the interaction. So we'll all have to wait 18 months to have those revealed.
Okay. Now my next question has to do with one of your answers in the FAQ that you posted online, that only about half of the excess deaths were from cardiovascular causes and the others were from causes such as cancer. I'm sure that nobody has any answer right now for why there might be excess cancer-related deaths. But if the non-cardiovascular causes of death were removed, would you have still been as concerned? In other words, if there were not 50-some excess deaths, but more like 25?
Yes, Dr. Simons-Martin. So, actually, the Q&A document does say about half of the deaths were from cardiovascular diseases. That was true for both the intensive and the standard glycemia groups. The excess deaths was in total mortality and also in combined cardiovascular causes. The majority of the excess deaths were in cardiovascular causes.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make it clear?
No.
Basically, there's no difference in terms of the distribution between the intensive and the standard group in terms of the causes of death.
Okay, that I understand. And I have one very small question regarding the lipid group. All of the other arms had specific targets for blood sugar, blood pressure. I didn't see anything in the protocol that set any kind of target figures for lipids.
I think your question really addresses the design of the randomization. It was between a fibrate plus statin versus a statin alone, and Dr. Binnington can address that.
Sure. As Dr. Friedewald indicated before, that this accord is a factorial trial, that basically means we have three concurrent trials going on at the same time, the glycemia trial that we're talking about today, the blood pressure trial, and the lipid trial. In both the glycemia trial and the blood pressure trial, we had strategies in terms of intensive versus standard treatments to try to reach certain goals. In the lipid trial, it's basically like the typical blinded, randomized clinical trial where we randomize half the people to one treatment, specifically fenofibrate, and the other group gets just placebo. So we're not targeting any kinds of LDL levels. All this being done in the context of good LDL control, so everybody in the trial is getting the standard. The notion behind the lipid trial is that people with diabetes are more likely to experience lipid abnormalities, specifically elevated triglyceride levels and lower HDLs. So that's why we're specifically testing in this trial fenofibrate versus placebo rather than the typical LDL change things that we usually do.
Well, you're also testing in both groups got a statin. Was there any stipulation as to the statin or the dose?
Yes, there is. Everybody is on, I can't remember off the top of my head, everybody's on Simisan, but I can't remember. And we're trying to titrate it so that everybody is getting their LDLs to a level less than 100, which they're actually achieving, which is along the guidelines promulgated by NIH and the AHA.
Thank you.
I think Dr. Buse is reminding us that they're receiving Simvastatin 20 milligrams.
Except for have cardiovascular disease, right, or whose LDL isn't less than 100, then they go to 40.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Michelle Cortez from Bloomberg News. Please go ahead.
Thanks for taking my question. You guys gave us the mortality rates in this group in patients who weren't in the ACCORD, 4-6%. Have you crunched out the actual mortality rate in these two separate groups? It looks like it'd be less than 1%. I'm wondering if you can give that to us and also tell us that, I know you don't want to give p-values, but if that difference was indeed statistically significant and not a result of chance. That's my first question. And then the second one is does this study give us any kind of insight at all in terms of treatment going forward, like, you know, should we not go with combination drugs, or is there something that looks better than another kind of a treatment? You know, there's always this concern as the diabetes gets worse, you add on more and more. Should we not be doing that, or any kind of guidance at all to doctors and patients? Thanks.
Well, as you recall, we indicated that in the mortality in the intensive treatment arm was 14 per 1,000 individuals per year, on an average of 4 years of follow-up, and in the standard treatment arm, 11 deaths per 1,000 individuals per year for an average of 4 years of follow-up. In addition, in our prepared comments, we do have a number of recommendations that we are providing to individuals, and I'll just reiterate those very quickly. First and foremost, individuals with diabetes should not change their diabetes treatment without first consulting with their healthcare provider. Second, we believe that the results of the preliminary results of the ACCORD trial are still very consistent with the ADA general recommendation about individualized care and advising people with diabetes to aim for an A1C of less than 7%. We do think, however, for this very special group of individuals with diabetes who had an average age of 62, had diabetes for an average duration of 10 years, and either had known heart disease or at very high risk, that less stringent A1C goals might be appropriate with an aim for more around 7%. And at this time, with the information we have at hand, these would be the recommendations that we would like to provide individuals and their caretakers.
Dr. Gerson, I just want to add a few things to remember, that this trial tested two different degrees of glucose lowering in people who had high glucose levels at the start. So they came in with an average A1C of 8.2%, and the two treatment strategies, one of them tried to drive that level right down to below 6%, and the other one tried to drive that level down to about 7.5%. And this tells us nothing, for instance, and to get into the trial, you had to have an A1C above 7.5% to even start, and the average was 8.2. So this doesn't tell us anything about what one should do with people whose A1C levels are already 7.5, you know, et cetera. In other words, if they start a study with reasonable A1C levels or lowers, it certainly doesn't mean that one should make it go higher. We don't know anything about what we should do with people who are newly diagnosed with diabetes or who have A1C levels that are in the high sixes, et cetera, at the time. This tells us that if it's particularly high, driving it down with a comprehensive approach that uses lifestyle, diet, as well as all the drugs available in our armamentarium today, increases mortality compared to driving it down more modestly to a level typical of what people have in the United States today.
Thank you. We'll take one last question.
Your last question comes from the line of Alice Debner from the Boston Globe. Your line is open. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much. My question was whether you could go over in a bit more detail what things besides rosiglitazone you actually looked at and ruled out as a cause of the increased deaths.
So again, all of that detail will be in the peer-reviewed publication. We can provide just a higher overview this morning, but again, that detail will be in the publication. Dr. Byington?
Yeah, we got, I can tell you that, as Dr. Nabel has indicated earlier, that we looked at almost the whole gamut of materials that we had used in our armamentarium. We looked at them individually, we looked at them in combinations, and we didn't see anything specific. But as far as the specific details of what we actually found, that'll be found in the publication.
So you looked at every drug that was used? Is that what you're saying?
Almost every class of drug that we happen to have in the trial.
And you looked at the glucose levels. And what else, were there other things that you also looked at?
Well, we looked at race and ethnicity and gender, basic demographic characteristics.
But let me just add that more that these are interim analysis, that these are being announced because of safety. That more and first of all, more data is being collected. These patients continue to be followed, and they're going to continue to be followed until for another 18 months because of the important blood pressure and lipid trial. And second, many more analyses need to be done to explore these and to try to come up with other possible explanations for this. We can only say what analyses have been done to date, and to date nothing has emerged, but this is going to continue to be done and will be looked at exhaustively. We also looked at, as I was earlier on, other things that could possibly be related to this, such as hypoglycemia, et cetera.
Yeah, we did. Again, just to reiterate, we're making the announcement today for safety reasons, and again, we anticipate the publication will be peer-reviewed and available within a short period of time. I do want to thank all of you who've called in today. We are very, very appreciative of the vital role that all of you play in communicating this important health information to the public. A recording of this press conference will be available at the following phone number within about 30 minutes or so, and that number is 1-800-475-6701, 1-800-475-6701. And the access code is 909685. Again, 909685. If you have any additional questions or would like follow-up, please contact the NHLBI press office at 301-496-4236. That's 301-496-4236. And again, the press release, question and answer sheet, and the prepared remarks have been posted at the NHLBI website, www.nhlbi.nih.gov, and a transcript of the teleconference will be posted within the next 2 days. Thank you all again very much.
Thank you for calling the AT&T Teleconference Replay System.